Yeah, and would be in negotiations with the United States Olympic Committee, and they would say, let me get this straight. You're creating the top program, and then you're going to take the money and redistribute it around the world. We said, yeah, that's the idea, solidarity. So you're going to take American money from American companies and give it to the communists?
Hello and welcome to Outlines, a podcast about sport, stories and the media. My name's Owen Connolly. Hope you're well. It is great to have you listening. There's a lot of talk, including on this podcast, about how the commercial foundations of sport are shifting, that changing media habits and models are challenging how sport makes money, its relationship with its fans and its storytelling environment. There's plenty of evidence for that, and you'll find plenty of opinions about what comes next. But today, we're going to be talking a bit about how we got here in the first place, how new thinking around broadcasting and sponsorship set the terms for sport's modern incarnation as a global industry. Michael Payne caught the start of that wave in the 1970s, and he had his own hand in that change as well. As marketing director of the IOC from 1983 to 2004, he was one of the architects of the TOP program, a worldwide sponsorship project that brought blue chip brands into the Olympic movement long term, completely resetting its commercial horizons and cultural role. And he's continued in various capacities and consultancies since then, both within Olympic sport — he's now attended the past 22 Olympic Games — and in Formula One and elsewhere. Now, Michael has reflected on that five-decade career in a new book, Fast Tracks and Dark Deals. It's a comprehensive primer on the modern history of the sports business and dense in personal encounters with the colourful characters, creativity and occasional chaos that helped shape it. There's even a brush with the KGB. We didn't quite get to all of that, but we did discuss the conditions that gave rise to those commercial and media innovations and why sport's capacity to generate stories was so integral to that transformation. Michael also shared his thoughts on the future of sport in general and the Olympics in particular. As always, if you're enjoying the podcast, then anything you can do to spread the word is much appreciated. Subscribe to the series, rate and review, tell colleagues, tell rivals, tell friends and nice-looking strangers. The social media details are in the show notes, where you can also find out more about Michael's book. Unsurprisingly, he's got a lot to say. Here is Michael Payne. A 100 days to go before Milan Cortina, of course, this week, as we're talking. I think it was yesterday or the day before. You know, are you preparations underway? Are you going to keep your streak going of getting to all these games?
Well, great question. Milan will be my 23rd Olympic Games if you take winter and summer, because I started out with Sarajevo. I know we'll have to see, because I think once the book is published, we'll have to see whether the IOC still will give me an accreditation or whether I will have been banished, because there are some quite colourful stories in there.
Yeah, what do you think about Milan, the Winter Olympics returning to Europe, Western Europe, for the first time in, well, since Italy had it in 2006, if I'm not wrong? They've become two very distinct properties, especially since that split from, you know, where you've got each one in different calendar years. You know, what do you think this means for the Winter Games?
Well, I think it is great to be back in the Alps. It's remarkable in some way that it's been two decades since the Winter Games were in the Alps. And I think the visual presentation, how it will look on television, I think will be stunning. But one also can't ignore the fact that it is by far the largest footprint ever that the Winter Olympics have been staged on. And on the ground, I think you're going to have two very separate Winter Games. One taking place in Milan and the ice, and the other in the Alps to the north on the snow, and it will not be possible to do both in the same day.
Mm.
You're going to have to decide either I'm staying in Milan or I'm going up to the Alps. It, you know, the recent Winter Games, you know, Sochi, Pyeongchang, Beijing, were all remarkably compact. This is spread out. But I think, and I was very involved in the original decision to split the games, Lillehammer 94 being the very first game, Winter Games, standing on their own. And at the time, a lot of people questioned whether the Winter Games was powerful enough property to stand on their own. No question, Lillehammer proved that. And I think it's even for those who attended Lillehammer and attended multiple games, it's probably still the greatest Winter Olympic Games ever. And, you know, look forward to Milan or Cortina. I mean, the Italians have a great heritage of winter sport, particularly in the north. And I think organizationally we'll do a great job, but it's going to be tough on the ground moving around.
Mm. I mean, do you think we'll come back to the kind of future of the Olympics in a bit, because it's not really what we're here for, but do you think that there will be an eye on whether this can be a different kind of Olympic format and also a different kind of Winter Games format as well? You know, we've got things like the Australian Summer Games on the horizon, which will have that slightly more spread footprint as well. But just in terms of how many viable Winter Olympic hosts there can be in the future, you know, whether you need to have this sort of mountain center and arena center, is that going to be you know, a feature of future events?
Well, I think it's certainly very much up for debate. And let's face it, the next Winter Olympic Games, which we'll see, will be in France, and we'll see them spread from Nice on the Mediterranean right up through the Alps and possibly be even more spread out.
Mm.
I think if you look back at the recent IOC presidential campaigns, there was quite a lot of debate about, is it a good idea to be spread out? Is it being driven by local political reasons?
Mm.
And is the IOC at risk of losing something that makes the Olympics special in terms of the intimacy? And I think the spread out nature of Milano will certainly prompt a lot of reflection within the IOC membership as to, is this a good idea? And frankly, with, you know, the global warming, what compromises do you have to make in terms of finding cities that are, or regions that are, snow sure? There still are a lot of places, and you've got, well, the following games in Salt Lake City will be quite compact, and they were very successful games back in 2002. And there are venues in Europe that I think can offer a lot more compact. So, you know, Coventry, you know, one of her key moves has been this pause and reflection, which I think is absolutely the correct way to take stock. And when we sort of see the results of that presented next summer, particularly coming off Milan, I expect there will be a lot of reflection as to, does it make sense to go down that direction? Is it possible to go back to something more compact?
Mm. Okay. Well, speaking of pausing and reflecting, you have a new memoir. Would you call it a memoir or an autobiography? It's a kind of reflection on your career in any case, Fast Tracks and Dark Deals, which is out imminently as we're releasing this. People who are listening to this who have a kind of industry background will know you and your career extremely well, but just for the benefit of anybody who might not, what's the scope of this? What kind of period are we reflecting on in the evolution of the sports industry?
Well, I began my career in the sports industry in the mid-70s, actually as a professional ski racer. And
so, yeah, close to your heart, Winter Olympics.
The Winter Olympics, particularly close to my heart. And because I was not on the national team, I turned professional and went to freestyle skiing, or hot dogging as it was known back then. In order to sort of fund yourself on the circuit, you needed to go out and find sponsors. And this was the very early days of looking to find sponsors. And I suppose the joke was I was a lot better at finding sponsors than I was at winning any of the competitions. So I began.
Still, people have made very fine careers doing that even today, Michael.
Yeah, well, I decided to make a career transition and started representing some of the skiers, but got into the industry at the ground floor in the late 70s, where it was still very much frankly, a cottage industry.
Hmm.
I mean, in the book, I talk about the early negotiations with FIFA when I was working at West Nally, and those negotiations being led by Horst Dassler and Patrick Nally. And the very first creation of a coordinated central marketing program, which West Nally drove, the idea of exclusivity, limited number of partners, the discussions with FIFA only had 4 employees. So you fast track forward 50 years to where the sports industry stands today, and it is the most remarkable evolution. With an industry that people, I mean, are passionate about, they care about their sport. And so the story about how sport became business, and in the process, business became sport, I thought was a story that should be told. And remarkably, there is very, very little written about how the industry came about. Mm. You've got the books on the NFL, the NBA, but on the international scene, virtually nothing. And so I said, look, you've been intimately involved with this journey. Initially, I started out just researching some of the key players. I mean, remarkably, there's no biography of Mark McCormack. There's no biography of Horst Dassler. And so the more I began looking into this and profiling them, the more I felt, you know what? Because I was there, because I knew them personally, because I was in the room negotiating with them, maybe it'll be a more interesting read to actually make it personal,
mm.
as opposed to being passive and observing from afar. And so then, you know, the book, you know, evolved. I'm not sure what the difference might be between autobiography or memoir, but it is at times personal reflection,
yeah.
of, you know, what was happening at the time, but also going on to look at, you know, who were these people and how did the industry come about. And, you know, at the end of the book, you know, say, well, I hope you enjoyed this journey over 50 years. What does the next 50 years have in hold?
Mm, yeah. And these are things that hopefully we'll get onto over the course of the kind of next half an hour or so. But what were your reasons for doing this now?
I had a little bit of spare time on my hands. No, I thought it's a story that needed to be told because it's an important part of history. And over the last couple of years, I sort of dabbled at it. I sort of shared the thinking with one or two journalist friends, and you know, they said, "This is a great story," and the way that you were sort of pulling it together, or pulling back the curtains and really, you know, explaining, you know, what was happening, you know, and the book is also called, you know, Dark Deals, in terms of what was going on at times behind the scenes. And so it becomes, you know, part spy thriller, but it's not fiction.
Mm.
And that was fun. It was fun to write it, and I hope it will be fun to read it, even if it is quite long.
What were some of the things that struck you or kind of surprised you? Because particularly within industry circles, a lot of the things that were created in this period, the idea of, you know, as you say, centralized marketing strategies or bundled up rights that get sold to broadcasters that are still with us, but are kind of maybe being challenged or pushed at the edges a bit in the last few years. But what are some of the things that struck you revisiting the start of this and reflecting on some of the things that have happened in between?
Well, I think it's always helpful to try and give context. You know, people talk about numbers, you know, a particular moment. And if you don't have proper reference, it's difficult to understand the evolution, the journey. You know, you say to somebody, it was 10 million. Well, is 10 million a lot, a little? Without a proper reference point, you've got, you know, no context. And I think maybe when sort of reading back, particularly over the early days, there was not some master strategy. There was not some sort of MBA business school coming out of Harvard or whatever. It was completely hit and miss, back of the envelope, with, you know, a group of people that, yeah, they said, yeah, we think this is the right way to go. I mean, in the case of the Olympics, if we didn't get it right, it was game over. You know, there was no future. You know,
yeah.
The Olympics, the IOC can shut the door, and, you know, the world moves on. And so it was a Wild West back then. And in the creation of the IOC strategy, similarly, you know, subsequently working with Bernie Eccleston closely with him and looking at the F1 strategy, a lot of people didn't want it to succeed for their own particular agendas. You know, the idea of getting the world signed up to a single marketing program, the top program, was probably a bigger achievement getting the world, you know, then 160 countries signed on than it was getting the sponsors. Because the countries who already had a bit of a marketing program, they didn't like the idea of centralizing control because it was a straightforward power grab, which, to truth be told, was what it was.
Mm.
The communist bloc, the last thing they wanted was for the West to increase their budgets, because then they would have to increase their budgets to stay competitive. Yeah, and would be in negotiations with the United States Olympic Committee, and they would say, let me get this straight. You're creating the top program, and you want to approach worldwide companies. We said, as you know, they said, we want to approach American companies. We said, no, they're worldwide brands. No, but they're based in America. And then you're going to take the money and redistribute it around the world. We said, yeah, that's the idea, solidarity. So you're going to take American money from American companies and give it to the communists to steal our gold medals? Get out of here. And that was the mindset when you were dealing within the Cold War. And it really was touch and go whether one was going to be able to pull it off.
Yeah.
And you then had similar stories in dealing with the companies, because, you know, they didn't believe in this idea of marketing. Where's the branding? Where's the advertising, the signage? So telling the stories of those early days, the process of what you were going through, the hit and miss, you know, and you fast track it forward now, 50 years, you're at a similar crossroads as to how it's going to evolve. And, you know, get it wrong, you know, and certain sports or events or organizations are really going to be struggling.
Mm. What was the insight at the time about what these kind of major events could be as a storytelling platform or as a brand marketing platform? What had you seen? I mean, you say it was, you know, some of it was quite improvised, but there's obviously got to have been sort of an animating idea or principle at work there.
Well, I mean, on the Olympic context, you had this incredible history. I mean, both from, you know, the 20th century, but also sort of the authenticity and the heritage of going back to ancient times. And, you know, long before you had broadcast television, you had incredible human interest stories around the Olympics. And the principle of bringing the world together once every 4 years, you know, was a powerful concept. Just a lot of the commentators at the time thought perhaps it was somewhat outdated and rather naive, because it wasn't going to, you couldn't sort of continue that philosophy. So you had that as, if you want, as a guiding light to try and sustain the principle. How you then put it together in a model that resonated with society and the business world as it stood today. You know, on the sponsorship front, all sponsorship in the 70s and 80s was driven around exposure, whether you got your name on the side of the track or on the athlete. And that was the full extent of marketing.
Mm.
Then along comes the Olympics, said, well, we don't have any advertising in the back, on the track, on the athlete. And so a lot of companies just said, what are you selling me then? There was no concept of how would you relate to the brand and how would you use the power of the brand and the imagery to reinforce your corporate brand. And it wasn't until we bought two companies onto the program that had zero experience in sports marketing. And they were Visa and 3M. And they looked at it completely differently as a, not as an afterthought to their marketing, but as the sort of the central point. And Visa, who were battling with American Express, they came up with a campaign that was groundbreaking. It shook up the sports marketing industry and it shook up the credit card industry, where they decided that if they could run a campaign saying, if you're going to the Olympic Games, don't forget to take your Visa card, because the Olympics doesn't take American Express. That was revolutionary, very successful for Visa, but was a wake-up call for a lot of companies and said, hang on, that's not how we perceived sports sponsorship. And even long-standing companies like Coca-Cola went back to the drawing board to say, we need to rethink this. Maybe we've been missing a trick, that there's something there that is a lot more powerful. And that launched the whole new thinking within the industry.
Mm. How much was all of this inevitable? And how much, I mean, you've talked about some of the principals who were very close to this and directly involved in creating these concepts and these packages to take to brands and media companies. How much would this have happened anyway, and you happened to be the guys who were around it? And how much was it something that you kind of you spotted the opportunity and you brought it into being, kind of thing?
I mean, great question. And I think it would be completely, I mean, wrong and arrogant to suddenly sort of pretend that one invented the whole sort of strategy. I mean, there were some critical undercurrents in play. If you look at the broadcasting, the moment you began to have more than one TV station in a country, you began to get competition.
Mm.
And sport being a powerful content, the moment you've got some competition running, you know, the rights fees and everything begin to evolve and grow. So there's no question that the Olympic world and all the sports world rode the rising interest of sport as a content thing. But I mean, one of the stories I tell in the book goes back to the 50s of an Australian former prisoner of war from, you know, Japanese prisoner of war camp, who, when he was survived, brought back and became the president of the Melbourne Olympic Organizing Committee. And they had no budget, no money. So he said, how the hell am I going to stage this? And he said, I know. There's this new medium of television. Sport is not news. Sport is entertainment. Therefore, the broadcasters should pay. And all the broadcasters said, no way. You know, print media doesn't pay. Radio doesn't pay. Agencies don't pay. Why the hell are we being singled out to pay? And you know what? The Melbourne Olympic Games were not broadcast outside of Australia. Mm. Zero coverage, because the broadcasters refused to pay. But 4 years later, they began to pay. But go back and just imagine, and if the industry had accepted that broadcasters didn't have to pay, where would sport be today?
Mm. Yeah. What else was happening in that period, kind of in the 70s and 80s in entertainment, that you were able to to glom onto kind of and develop some of these commercial concepts. I think, you know, because there's an interesting parallel now. Everyone's trying to make sense of a sort of post monolithic broadcast and print media era and you know, how sport makes its way in a much more diffuse sort of media environment. And sport's not alone in that, incidentally. What were you looking around and seeing in television, in advertising, in, you know, Hollywood and other entertainment forms at the time?
I mean, on the television front, you know, it began to say, how do you evolve the mindset from thinking about this to just being a 17-day sporting event to a broader journey?
Mm.
How do you, you know, in the very early days, take the cameras away from the field of play and begin to tell the story about the family, about the friends, because that's what the people were wanting to engage and watch. Yes, they wanted to watch the 100-meter sprint. But if you then would go on to tell the journey about how did those athletes get there?
Mm.
Where were they living? Who was their family? And so, you know, what today with Netflix and all of these sort of human interest beyond, you know, the racetrack, beyond the field of play, I think those early days of recognizing that people love stories.
Mm.
And so the more you would go out to tell them the stories, and that wasn't always easy to convince the broadcaster, because you would be speaking to the sports department, and the only thing they knew was starter's gun goes off and you cross the finishing line. Well, why do we need to go and do anything else? Equally, you know, the idea of, if you're going to form a strategic partnership, maybe it shouldn't be every game's changing the broadcaster or having a new negotiation. If you're in this for the long term, why don't you make a long-term broadcast deal? And that was an idea that I came up with the Australian broadcaster, Gary Fenton, in a bar in Monaco. Just brainstorming. And you know, it comes back to your earlier question about the master strategic plan. Well, you didn't have some business consultancy, McKinsey, you know, drawing up, you know, with great PowerPoints or whatever. It was an element of hit and miss.
Mm.
And I think at times that might be missing in some aspects of the management of sport today, that people are so scared of making a mistake. You know, and if you don't make mistakes, you don't learn. If you're not willing to make a mistake, you don't try out new things. And you sort of become drowning in sort of your process and bureaucracy, as opposed to having an element of innovation and entrepreneurship.
Mm.
And that's as true for big companies, as for governmental organizations, as to sports bodies. You have to find a balance to continue to innovate, and you won't always get it right.
Yeah.
And if you're scared, you won't move forward.
Yeah. Having been back through your career history and on that point, what were some of the biggest challenges that you faced personally? And are there any kind of regrets that you've got, or any of those misses that you were kind of drawn back to and thought about differently?
Well, I think the biggest single challenge was getting the world signed up to a one-stop marketing program. I mean, not even the UN or whatever else can get agreement, you know, of a united strategy. And what today may look like as obvious, back then was real risk. So that would be, you know, the challenge. I mean, fast forward maybe to the Salt Lake City corruption scandal, which taught you a lesson as to how fragile the whole process is, how quickly you can go from one day on an absolute high, everything looking, you know, very positive for the outlook and the future, and the next day going into the office and not knowing if the organization would make it through the day. And that happening day after day for 3 months. And it taught lessons such as, if you don't properly protect your brand, you know, the whole thing can come tumbling over very, very quickly. Another important lesson was, well, if you're going to have a crisis and a real proper meltdown, death-defying crisis, might as well see how you can turn it around to your advantage, which is subsequently what Samranch did. And we pushed through 30, 40 years of reform in 6 months and eventually came out of it much stronger.
Yeah.
Didn't necessarily look like it at the day.
What are some of your broader reflections? Was something I was keen to talk about a bit. You know, fairly or unfairly, the commercialization of these organizations, particularly that sort of mega event delivery organization, FIFA and the IOC, the commercialization and the acceleration and the expansion of the bid process and all the rest of it is seen as having delivered these kind of after effects of corruption and what have you. What are your reflections on that? I mean, the working theory was always these are organizations that suddenly got a lot of money very quickly and weren't set up for them from a governance perspective. But I mean, having been closer to it, how do you reflect on that?
Well, I think that's a fair observation. I mean, the money did suddenly come in very fast. And you know, particularly when you're dealing with a global culture, you know, the mindset, shall we say, from Northern Europe to Southern Europe to other continents may be different. But equally, I sort of, you know, the Scandinavians have always been very good at sort of standing and pontificating of how they are whiter than white and everything. And yet one of the biggest corruption scandals in sport recently, you know, was a Norwegian, was the head of the International Biathlon Federation. So there's no question that the sports bodies had to evolve their governance, frankly, in exactly the same way as the corporate world, as they were rolling out their, you know, business worldwide, you know, and companies like Siemens or General Electric, you know, their lobbying process to acquire big contracts around the world, you know, it was no different than at times how the sports world was operating. So one has seen over the last half century an evolution. Yes, because the sports world is perhaps under the magnifying glass, because the slightest thing that happens with the Olympics or the World Cup, you know, is front page news. The same thing happening, interestingly, when the Salt Lake crisis broke, the same week there was a little misunderstanding at the European Commission, and the whole commission had to resign because they had lost, I've forgotten how many tens of billions of dollars. That was on the newspaper front page for about 2 days. The Olympics was front page for 6 months. Mm. And when every single Pulitzer Prize winning journalist had finished his investigation, the total sum of money that was, if you want, talking about being colorful, was less than $500,000. And Samranch used to say to me, I don't understand. Why? I said, well, sir, maybe take it as a compliment because it shows how much people care. And it doesn't matter whether it's $500,000 or $5. You've put the Olympics up on a pedestal. We have to live to that standard.
Yeah.
And it's taken FIFA, shall we say, longer to evolve their governance. And is everything perfect today? No. Is everything perfect in any government around the world? No. All company. I mean, part of it is the nature of society. The sports world, you know, probably takes up more oxygen because people are interested in what's happening and they care about it. They frankly probably couldn't care less about Siemens and how they do their deals in the Middle East.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that the sports world has to build and maintain its integrity. And particularly, I think the standards now expected of younger generations has raised the bar on how sport has to operate.
Yeah, I suppose it's a version of the thing that you notice with human stories in sport more generally, being, you know, it's a, as much as it's a stage for excellence and effort and everything on the field of play, it's also can be an incredibly powerful setting for kind of, you know, some of the more venal aspects, I guess, of human nature. You were involved with the IOC directly until I think 2004 as marketing director, but you've stayed kind of in or near the movement for a lot of that time since. You know, you have this long chain of Olympic attendance. What have you made of how the Olympics has evolved, particularly in the last decade, as a sort of commercial media event storytelling platform?
I think the presidency of Thomas Bach really brought back a level of energy, innovation that was missing. And maybe this goes through periods. You had under Samaranch incredible innovation and growth, frankly, from bankruptcy to building the whole future. He was succeeded by President Rog, who, you know, being a surgeon, was a very safe, stable set of hands. But frankly, there was very little new thinking or innovation that came out of his presidency. And so when Bach took over, it was very, if you want, refreshing. I don't think he got everything right, but, you know, the overall report card has to be very positive. And now, you know, clearly everybody's waiting to see how Coventry takes the Olympic movement forward. I think there is sort of some ways a contradiction that you look at the Paris Olympic Games and probably one of, if not the most successful Olympic Games ever. And everybody around the world basically just said, that was great. That was fun. It was not only brilliant sport, but it was a brilliant celebration. And coming off Tokyo, you know, which was expected to be like that, but obviously under the shadow of COVID, you couldn't deliver that celebration in the same way. But for all of the success of Paris, I think there are two very dark, very dangerous storm clouds on the horizon. One is the increasing political weaponization of sport, where politicians and governments are starting to use sport again as a tool in their international geopolitics. When I joined the IOC, it was the middle of the Cold War, and the whole perspective of boycotts were at the forefront. Samaranch was able to pretty much bury the boycott agenda. And for 30 years, things were pretty quiet. And you didn't have politicians wading in and using sport as a tool. Those days are over. And every single week, you've got sport at the forefront, whether it was the debate over Indonesia refusing to allow, you know, the athletes, the Israeli athletes to come in. How do you rationalize that sanctions when America is still blocking Cuban athletes? What do you do with, you know, from the Ukraine, Russia, Belarus affair? You know, it's getting very polarized, and I think very dangerous ground for the whole thing unraveling. So that's storm cloud one. Storm cloud two is the very business model of sport. The how you monetize sport through content, what has traditionally been broadcasting, or partnership and sponsorship, it's all changing. And all of those programs have to evolve, and have to evolve today, not tomorrow. Because if you wait till tomorrow, you may not be around a week later. So I think the challenges for leadership are serious. equally, if you get it right, you know, the potential opportunity to the future, it continues to be massive because people care so much about sport. Although, you know, with the younger generation, you've got to re-engineer how you are communicating and engaging with them in their sort of new environment where they are not naturally going to be sitting down on the sofa and staying still for 2 hours.
Mm. So if you were doing again today what you were doing in the early 1980s and you were devising a marketing strategy for the Olympics, where would you start?
I would go on a proper listening tour of the big marketeers, the big companies, and really make sure I understand where their head is parked. You can't do that by sitting in Ivory Tower in Lausanne or in Zurich. I would make sure that I had an external expert counsel to really help me map out the thinking for the future. I mean, something the last time round there was a turning point on the whole broadcast front was the late 90s with the arrival and the explosion of the internet revolution. And back then, everybody was saying, well, television's a dinosaur. You've got to go and sell your rights to the web. You know, I tell the story because back then, that was the considered opinion. And I said, I can't work out how to get any money out of the web yet. But I bought in the experts, Martin Sorrell from WPP and others. And we sat around the table for, you know, a day or two and really tried to make sure one was understanding where this is going. And it's how I became very close to Bernie Eccleston, because he said, what do you think of this internet thing, Michael? I said, well, I think down the road it's going to be important, but I can't work out how to monetize it today. And I'm not about to give up the $1 billion contracts with TV until I have worked it out. Mm. And, you know, a lot of the commentators are saying, well, you're being old school, you'll miss the train. I said, well, you know, I think we could always get on the train whenever we want. And if we miss it for a year, better to miss it than completely blow the whole thing up. So I think, you know, the pace of change, you've got to get out there to really understand it.
Mm.
I mean, interesting story the last week was the IOC and Saudi Arabia parting company on their esports strategy.
Yeah.
I'm not sure they were ever on the same page to begin with. And I think the deal was probably way too rushed. And then only as they began to get around the table, did they perhaps come to terms and realize we can't be good bed partners because we have completely different philosophy and options.
Yeah. Okay, well, lots of fascinating developments there. I mean, we're running out of time, but you know, there's several podcasts we could dive into, or several podcasts worth of stuff. What's next for you, Michael?
Well, I'm still working very closely with Alibaba and looking at the future of AI in sport, which has the potential to revolutionize everything.
Mm.
You know, similarly. Also sort of brokered the big deal between Lenovo and FIFA and looking at how on that front the technology will evolve. So a lot of the work currently is looking at the future of technology and how best it will evolve and partner with sport, which is fascinating, but equally, you know, everybody's got to really make sure they understand what they're doing.
Yeah.
Which isn't to say that you don't experiment, you don't take some risks, but it's getting more complicated and the pace of change and disruption is getting ever greater, which makes it interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Talking about a conversation for another time. Okay, there's three questions that we ask every guest on the podcast. The first is, do you have an origin story or something that sparked your interest in sport?
Probably watching the film Downhill Racer in the late 60s, which was sort of the focused on the World Cup of skiing, and that's what maybe hooked me into the world of skiing. and launched my sort of ski career, which, as I said at the beginning of the podcast, was fairly short lived, but it got me going.
Yeah. What's your favorite piece of sports storytelling? Is it downhill races still?
No, actually, one of my favorite and most emotional stories, and it cuts to the heart of the Olympic storytelling. I'll try and tell it very quickly. There was an American canoeist called Bill Havens, who was due to compete at the 1924 Olympics in Paris. He had won every single competition and was the clear lock-in favorite for the gold medal. And as he was about to make his plans to get on the boat to go to the Olympics, his wife told him that she was pregnant. And he was then left with the dilemma, do I go, miss the birth of my son, or do I stay with my wife? And eventually, he decided to stay with his wife, not go to the Olympics, miss up on the gold medal. And for the next 30 years, he wondered whether he'd made the right decision. And he then received a telegram from his son. Dear Dad, I'm coming home from the Helsinki Olympics with the gold medal you should have won. And I think those, even if there's no visual record of that, the sheer power of those human stories are what makes it so unique and special.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a lovely story. What is a sports story that you'd like to tell or see someone else tell? I mean, maybe that's one for anybody listening who's looking for material, but are there any others that you'd be keen to see explored?
I talk about in the book, people ask the question, what was your favorite sporting moment? And obviously being privileged to see so many, but often the most emotional moments were actually not on the field of play, but sitting on a bus carrying the Olympic torch and engaging with the other torchbearers who have been selected, as community heroes. And again, there's another story there where the runners on the bus don't know who each they are. They're asked to introduce each other by the sort of guide as they're preparing. You've got 10 runners on the bus just getting to get off the bus, and each person introduces themselves. And one lady turns around and says, why are you running? She says, well, I had an organ transplant. I had a new kidney from an anonymous donor. And every so, congratulations on recovering. And the next lady spoke up, and why are you running? So, well, I was an anonymous organ donor. And she's the one who had given the kidney for this lady to survive. And they didn't know. And so these, again, it comes back to the human interest stories and the sheer power of the sports platform to tell that story. Yeah. And I think, the more those stories can be told, the more people are going to be engaged.
Okay. What a lovely note to finish on. Fast Tracks and Dark Deals is out this month. So I will put some details in the show notes. But Michael, it's been fascinating and really enjoyed it. Thanks very much.
Well, great to be with you. And congratulations on continuing the podcast. And maybe hope to be back again one day and tell a few more stories.
Great stuff. Outlines is an original production from 2640.